For the week of May 29th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 105, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in a very blurry New York City, I'm Michael Giltz.
I don't know why New York City is blurry, but welcome back to the United States.
Well, thank you. Just got back last night and went to the eye doctor this morning to get a prescription update. They put drops in my eyes. I can't see. Everything is blurry. And I'm trying to read a computer screen while we do our show, of course, to get information and all the articles we link to. And it's all blurry. That's exactly what you go for the eye doctor for, right?
Yeah, well, precisely. And we should probably mention that the reason we are so delayed this week in posting the podcast and recording the podcast is because you were traveling.
Well, holiday weekend on Monday, and I was unfortunately traveling on Tuesday. But we have a great guest lined up. And, you know, we should say we didn't even say on our 100th episode. It's great. You know, the one thing we keep doing the show, we apologize when we're late. Sometimes we get it out on Tuesday, sometimes Wednesday, sometimes Thursday, sometimes Monday. The one thing that keeps us going is the fact that thousands of people are listening, and we really do appreciate it, and it makes it feel worthwhile.
Yes, indeed. And you mentioned our guest on today's show. We will be joined by Ty Burr, the film critic for the Boston Globe. He wrote an article last week about how some major theater chains are leaving moviegoers in the dark by regularly misusing digital projection equipment. Of course, that's something I know a little bit about. Sony may not want anyone to be in the dark about their upcoming adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. There is some question over whether the studio may have leaked a pirated version of the film's restricted trailer as part of an underground viral marketing campaign. Facebook may be dancing to a new tune thanks to Spotify. We'll talk about a surprising announcement from the organizers of the Coachella Music Festival. And then some woman named Oprah Winfrey decided she didn't like television anymore and ended her show last week. So a lot of people tuned in to see the final episode. They may not have been watching the commercials, however, and we'll explain why. Of course, we cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who will fill us in on the record-breaking weekend's box office.
Yes, it was a huge weekend at the box office. It was Memorial Day in the U.S. It was also a bank holiday in the U.K. I don't know. Was it a holiday all over the world? I'm not quite sure. Certainly in a fair amount of Europe and the U.S., two big markets for the movies, it was a holiday weekend. So all the figures we have are a little vague. Some of them are three-day weekends. Some days are five-day weekends. Some days, some totals include Monday. It's all over the map this week. But we'll get you as much information as we can, as accurately as possible. We do have a worldwide box office. The number one movie at the box office worldwide this weekend was The Hangover 2 at $205 million, which includes Wednesday through Monday, frankly. And that's just a huge number for an R-rated movie, a huge number for a comedy. It set all sorts of records everywhere it played. At number two at the box office was Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. It grossed $180 million worldwide. It's at $643 million. It hit $600 million in 12 days. If you just looked at the U.S., you'd say, oh, this isn't really doing that well. The franchise is slowing down. But if you look at it worldwide, this is still a monster series. At number three was Kung Fu Panda 2 from DreamWorks. It grossed $124 million worldwide. Again, the U.S. was a little disappointing, but 3D really helped it in a lot of countries like China. And you're starting to see big figures from China now. You know, $16 million opening for this movie and that movie. It's really starting to become a real force at the box office. At number four was Fast Five at $22 million. It's grossed $545 million worldwide. And number five is Bridesmaids, the female version of The Hangover. That grossed $22 million. It is at $85 million, basically in the U.S. only. It's opened a little bit overseas, but not really. It's just getting going. But what's amazing there is how well it's doing, even though the film it's sort of based on in a way. I'm sure they pitch it as the female version of The Hangover. It's still doing very, very well in the U.S., even though The Hangover 2 is out at the box office. And number six is Thor at $12.4 million. That's at $413 million worldwide. Excuse me, $13.4 million. That's how blurry my vision is. At number seven is Rio, the animated film, another $5.7 million worldwide. It's basically done. It's at $457 million total. And number eight in Japan, a big release, Princess Toyotomi, an animated film that grossed $3.8 million. At nine is Sunny, a really big box office hit in South Korea. I wonder if it'll come to the U.S. It grossed $3.4 million this weekend, and it's at $23.6 million worldwide. And as we've known for a while, South Korean cinema is very influential and very big in a lot of other Asian countries. So that will translate into other parts of the world, and I'm sure it'll come to the U.S. in some shape or form. And at number 10 in the worldwide box office, Woody Allen, of all people, Midnight in Paris, $1.9 million. It's at about $15 million worldwide. And it's shaping up to be one of his biggest hits in a long, long time.
Why do you think that is?
I have no idea, except he's a beloved figure. It has, you know, he's made a number of movies in Europe now. He's always been very big there. And this is really a European hit. And it is a very light, entertaining one. It's certainly a painless Woody Allen movie. Some of them have been very bad in recent years. This is one of the ones that's very enjoyable. And unlike Match Point and the other very good movies he's made in the last 10 or 15 years, this is a light film. If he succeeded in the last 10 or 15 years, it's usually been with dark, serious movies. This is a Woody Allen comedy that people are embracing. So it's probably the first time in a long time.
But it's not like a comedy like Manhattan. Well, I guess Manhattan was more of a dramedy.
Yeah.
Or Annie Hall. It's not like Annie Hall at all. It's not like his classic comedies.
Well, it's lighthearted. It's akin somewhat to Purple Rose of Cairo. Audiences are enjoying it. Again, you know, $50 million worldwide. The movie cost, I think, $30 million to make. So he's a long way from having a blockbuster, but it's fun to see Woody Allen's name in the top 10 worldwide.
But it made, you know, $1.9 million on 58 screens. That's pretty good. And yeah, that's just here in the U.S.
Yeah, that's right. That's in the U.S. And the overseas figures are a little dicey. I couldn't get a roundup for them. He's out of the top 10. But I do know that he's still grossing money overseas, and his total is about $50 million worldwide. It's very hard to get country cut by country figures, so we're just pulling where we can from Variety and Hollywood Reporter.
And Terrence Malick is doing well. You know, another film we saw at Cannes, the Tree of Life.
Yes, it's doing gangbuster business in limited release. It's on just four screens. It did $448,000. That's about $122,000 per screen. It's the largest per screen total in Fox Searchlight history. Again, this is not a big major commercial artist. His biggest hit by far was The Thin Red Line, which grossed $38 million. Basically, nothing else he's done has come even close to that. I'm not sure how The Tree of Life will work. It's not a very commercial film. It's sort of a head trip movie, like 2001 A Space Odyssey. It'll be fascinating to see if this keeps up.
I saw a tweet from Fox Searchlight Pictures that said, to Los Angeles moviegoers, the Arclight in Hollywood has a screening of Tree of Life at 4:20 p.m. every day. And I thought, why are they pointing that out? And then I realized, oh, 4:20, it's kind of slang for marijuana.
Oh, my God, that's hilarious that Fox Searchlight did that.
I thought, well, what are you saying? We need to be high to enjoy the movie?
Yeah, well, it doesn't. I actually suggested that to some people as well. It is, though, I think you should first see it sober. I actually don't like to see anything or go to a concert, even a little buzzed or drunk or anything, because I don't know what I think of it then. So it was the biggest Memorial Day weekend in U.S. history. It topped the previous record set in 2007. It was up over 50% from the same weekend last year. I haven't been able to get the actual dollar figures for where this year is compared to last year, but they were talking about how the box office, like last week and the weekend before, was down X percent, which translated to about $4 or $5 million from the year prior. And they're like, oh, you know, what a disaster. And I've always been saying, you know, one hit movie and this deficit is erased. This has been a huge weekend. The Hollywood Reporter had a silly line. It said the overall uptick in theater traffic at the domestic box office was a welcome respite for the film business, which has suffered one of the worst box office slumps in history.
Well, I can't counter that. I don't know whether it was one of the
worst. It wasn't. It absolutely wasn't. It was probably like the fifth or sixth biggest box office year so far in history. You know, it's down from record highs or down from last year, but it is not even remotely down historically.
Well, last year you had both Avatar and Alice in Wonderland in the first half of the year, in the first quarter of the year. So you
exactly.
had two multi-billion dollar movie and $1 billion movie being released. This year you didn't have that. Box office was off at one point 20%.
About one weekend compared to another weekend.
Well,
not,
no, just, you know, year to year.
Year.
No, year.
Yeah, but not the entire gross of the year overall.
Yeah, no, that's what they're talking about. Year to year, it was off at one point. Well, remember, this was only at one point, 20%. By March, it was off about 17%. But now, after this past weekend, revenue is down about 9% with attendance off 10%. So it's actually climbing back, and with Green Hornet and... Or is it Green Lantern?
Make box office comments from like February and January is so ridiculous.
Well, I agree. I actually posted something on Celluloid Junkie that I think I'm sure to get blasted for that really kind of took the folks to task who are, they kind of hype all of these box office figures by saying, you know, it's the greatest, the highest opening of an R-rated comedy. Yeah, in May.
I'm a fat guy.
Yeah, when Memorial Day falls on a Monday, you know, it's just kind of ridiculous.
Exactly. Well, we're here to give you the skinny. It's very big weekend at the box office, very big weekend for The Hangover 2, despite horrible rating and reviews. Not a great weekend, but a solid weekend for Kung Fu Panda 2, even though it had very good reviews, and people are liking that movie a lot. Audiences love both these movies, and Kung Fu Panda 2 is from DreamWorks. It's the second in what should be a franchise, but in fact, DreamWorks stock fell because people have the perception that the movie underperformed, though in fact, if you look at it worldwide, it's in pretty good shape.
Well, it opened below what Kung Fu Panda opened at in theaters a couple years back. So Kung Fu Panda opened to $60 million. This film, Kung Fu Panda 2, opening to $47.6 million. And, you know, everybody's talking about how the 3D take was only 45% instead of 55 or 65%. Take into consideration, though, that it did not open on IMAX, so that would have probably boosted. Again,
but none of that matters. What matters is how much money it makes. I mean, the studio doesn't care whether it makes it in 2D, 3D, IMAX. Audiences don't care. Studios don't care. All they care about is how much money it makes. And if you look at the worldwide box office, $125 million weekend, with audiences giving it the highest rating of any film out this week, they love it. They give it an A. Then it's, you know, word of mouth should be good. And it's a family film. It should have good legs. And if it's on 2D, who cares?
Well, on a micro level, you're correct. I think on a macro level, certainly studios and in the industry at large kind of looks at trends and kind of says, well, gee, which direction should we head? And it is somewhat interesting that 3D films are being not necessarily avoided, but more people are choosing to see these films in 2D.
No, they're absolutely being avoided. You know, a year or two ago when it was new, people 55 or 65% of an opening weekend gross or a movie's total gross would come from 3D, right?
Yeah, like between 65 and 75. But again, that was Avatar. And that was...
Well, know, other movies, Alice and other ones.
And Shrek,
right?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So people said, well, that was fun, but my kids hate the glasses. It costs a lot of money. It's not that exciting. And it's doubling practically the cost of a ticket to take a kid to a movie.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I took my kids to see Kung Fu Panda 2. And for four tickets, it was $53.
Yeah, that's insane. How was it? Did they enjoy it?
They did enjoy it. They actually referenced it for the rest of the weekend. So that's usually a good sign.
After your kids came home from Kung Fu Panda 2, did you show them the trailer for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
You know, ironically, I did not do that, especially since it was a red band trailer, which means it is restricted. You know, red band trailers are in place of green band trailers. A green band trailer is approved for all audiences and can be put in front of any movie. A red band trailer is really restricted and can only be put in front of, I guess, rated R films.
And so this trailer that leaked online, the studio denies that it was a stunt.
Well, they're not saying anything. So, of course,
I saw in today's Hollywood Reporter, they denied that it was
okay,
a stunt.
Okay. Over the weekend, though, I guess it hit YouTube on Saturday, and it was not a clear picture of the trailer. It was a pirated version of the trailer filmed on a camcorder. I thought, if this is a Sony stunt, the last thing in the world they want to be doing is justifying in any way, shape, or form camcording a film.
Right. Well, that's for authenticity's sake, obviously.
Right. Well, they wanted to make it look like an authentic pirated film.
So you could only see the trailer in theaters. It was available to be seen in theaters, and somebody...
There were a few theaters in the U.S. that were showing it, but mostly it was overseas where the red band trailer was playing. And what led people to think, gee, this must be a Sony plant, is why is the MPA red band advisory in front of a trailer being shown in Europe?
Well, it was shown in some places in the U.S.
One or two, yes.
Well, isn't that all it takes?
Yeah. However, the person that uploaded this only joined YouTube the previous day, and they are from Holland, where this red band trailer was shown.
I'm confused. You said the red band trailer wasn't shown in it would only be shown in the U.S. in the sense of with the red band warning on it.
Well, there's the rub. The question is, why would the MPAA's advisory notice be on any trailer being shown overseas? Maybe they are on trailers overseas, and for operational purposes, the studio doesn't take the advisory off. I don't know.
I mean, the person could have just been disguising where they were from, right?
Well, possibly, yes. But then there was talk about, well, gee, you know, it starts off looking like a camcorder version, but then the video gets better and becomes less shaky, and the audio is fantastic. And I have to say, this is the second time that a David Fincher film, a trailer for a David Fincher film, has caused this huge amount of buzz.
What was the last one?
The Social Network.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah, the trailer, the teaser trailer for The Social Network that kind of used I'm a Creep.
Oh,
music.
Right. Yeah. It was a very good trailer. So did this stunt work? Was it a good trailer? Did it get good reaction? Were a lot of people looking at it on YouTube, or did it just get some press attention?
No, I mean, I think at this point, 1.25 million people have seen the trailer. It got a lot of press attention, and the trailer is actually pretty good. Doesn't tell you what the story is, but I think everybody knows the story. It's a remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the Stieg Larsson trilogy.
Mm-hmm. An English language version of the story.
Yes, because of course the books have already been turned into a film, and mm-hmm. a film series, and a successful one at that in Sweden.
A relatively successful, I mean, a very commercially successful one, though audiences obviously weren't thrilled with it because each edition of the movie dropped significantly from the one before. So they showed out for the first one, and then they lost their audience a lot in the second one, then lost a lot more in the third. So there's a lot more potential than they tapped with that one. Well, so a stunt well done then. You know,
yeah, I mean, I think if it is a stunt that Sony perpetrated, I think the idea of it being a camcorder stunt is not a good one.
You're saying if they're gonna release a trailer surreptitiously, they should do it without
making it look like somebody walked into a movie theater with a camcorder.
I don't see the big disconnect there. Well, I don't think they're encouraging people to do it, but they're just saying they're going for the rebel look.
Well, but they are discouraging people from camcording their movies. And certainly when we as journalists show up to a screening, they basically strip search us.
Well, the message is we can do it, but if you do it, we'll throw you in jail.
Pretty much, yes. Kind of like when you pirate music.
That's right. There's a lot more music news. I mean, every day somebody new is announcing a music deal, music in the cloud, music service. What's the latest?
Well, looks like Facebook is going to do a deal with Spotify, though everybody's denying everything. And the Spotify service, of course, being a European service that is still trying to launch here in the United States, and they've cut deals with reportedly two record companies with two large record company deals to go. So they haven't been able to launch here. It's a streaming service where you can stream millions of songs, and they are going to embed it into Facebook.
Well, the last laugh would be with them if they were able to link up with Facebook, right?
You know, with 500 million users, it would definitely dominate. They're going to, if they do it, it will only be in Europe until such time as Spotify is licensed here in the United States.
Oh, so they haven't cleared up their problems yet with the record labels?
No, not at all.
They've made no progress.
No progress. Kind of Google has made no progress with the record labels, but it looks like Apple has.
Okay, but Facebook is launching this in Europe only.
There's no confirmation yet as to a deal between either of them.
Oh, okay. It's a possibility.
Yeah, and they're wondering, is it going to be called Facebook Music? Is it going to be called Spotify on Facebook? It'll be embedded into your homepage somehow, into your news stream. So it'll be interesting to see.
Well, you know, an interesting way to share songs I like, that's something that I might prove useful to me.
Yeah, that's pretty much what they want to do. They want to make it so that your friends can see what you're listening to, you can see what your friends are listening to, you can listen to music simultaneously. I mean, it makes sense.
And now Apple has announced, of course, iCloud, as we've already talked about, and Steve Jobs will be back in person to beat the drum on this. They're delaying the iPhone 5 until the fall, perhaps because of production problems, because of the earthquake in Japan and other reasons.
Well, they just released it on Verizon. I think they want to give Verizon some time to actually sell it.
Mm-hmm. And what are they doing about digital music specifically? Is it all about being able to listen to all your music on your iPhone no matter where you go, or what's the deal here?
Yeah, they want you to be able to listen to it on your computer, on your iPhone, on your Apple TV. So it's basically a way to, it's a music locker, the same way Amazon and the same way Google have created music lockers.
What I don't get is I have 500,000 tracks, if not more, on my iTunes. Obviously, I'm in the industry, but I also buy a lot of music. If I have to pay, you know, thousands of dollars just to have access to it online, that doesn't really help me. And I think most people, again, can fit almost everything they own on any standard iPhone. So I just don't, you know, you can fit 500 albums on your iPhone. So where is the need for an iCloud to hear all your songs? You can have everything. Most people don't own that many albums.
What happens when your hard drive crashes or your iPod gets stolen or your iPhone, you know, goes on the fritz?
This is an elaborate backup scheme. For $80, buy a backup hard drive, as well you should. You're a fool if you don't. And I've been a fool in the past, and I'm not anymore. I have a backup hard drive here, another one in a separate location. I've learned my lesson. This is not a backup hard drive solution. This is meant to be some sort of brave
service.
New world.
Yeah,
right. But I don't get it. If you can fit every song you own on your iPhone already, and that's true for the 90% of people do not own more than 500 CDs.
Are you surprised that the entertainment industry is trying to sell consumers something they don't need?
Well, I'm wondering if there's something I don't get.
I think that really it's just about not owning the music to begin with. It's about kind of renting it.
Well, yeah, but this is all about music you do own. This is not about a subscription service.
You know, what I think is interesting is that, a couple things in regards to this Apple news.
Okay.
One, if you upload a version of a song that is pirated and may be in poor audio quality, Apple will replace it with a higher quality version. So all those people who pirated like really bad tracks of music will now have better tracks to listen to.
Because they have no way to determine whether you purchased it legally or not?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, because I have, you know, 100, 500,000 songs, and I'd love to upgrade my song quality for my MP3. I've always done the sort of the best quality I can within reason. You know, I haven't done, you know,
lossless one, and FLAC.
Yeah,
and,
right, because that becomes insane. It fills up your computer quick. But that would be great for me. But when I looked at the Amazon service, it was literally $5,000 to upgrade my... Yeah, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, no, their service is too expensive, although not for Lady Gaga, apparently. but, you know, it looks like, you know, Apple will upgrade the music for you. And what I think also is interesting is that the music industry was under the thumb of Apple when it came to digital music in the past, and they weren't all that fond of being controlled by one large technology company, and yet they've returned to Apple again. They're the only group, Apple is the only group that will have licenses. Google was prepared to spend $100 million up front and pay the four major music labels for licenses, and talks just broke down. I guess $100 million wasn't enough.
So Apple's the only one that's made it work in a way. They're the biggest, practically the biggest record store in the world.
Yes. And they're going to be one of the few companies that has licenses with all the record labels to stream music.
And of course, they're not really upgrading your songs. They basically have the highest quality song version available in the cloud, and they're not making a new copy just for you. So they're letting you have access to the one that they have. There'd be no point for them to create an inferior version quality of a song just so you could maintain your same digital quality. So they're not doing you a favor. They're just saying, okay, this is our track of the Beatles Yesterday. It's in the best quality we can provide. We're not going to downgrade it just to match what you have on your computer.
Right. It's this whole concept of deduplication. And right. That means that they're not going to store your copy of Yesterday and my copy of Yesterday and their copy of Yesterday. Yeah. They'll just store their copy of Yesterday and point to it for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, speaking of upgrades, did you hear this news from Golden Voice about Coachella?
Well, what is Golden Voice? Is that the company that oversees the event?
Yeah, Golden Voice is a concert promoter, and one of their big events was Coachella, which is a music and arts festival every year in Indio, California, out in the desert. I attend it almost every year. I've been going since it started in 1999, including this past year, and it was a very good year this past year. And next year, I will have my choice as to whether to go April 13th through 15th, or April 20th through 22nd. They are doubling down on their music festival.
But the idea is not that they're going to have a whole bunch of separate people each weekend. It's basically the same people they're trying to bring back both weekends?
Yes. As a matter of fact, on their website, they stated, we will attempt to produce two identical festival weekends. That means same lineup, same art, same place, different people. And the different people in this case is a different audience.
Well, this is really interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. It's going to be really hard to pull off because, you know, acts have to...
Well, but they'll commit.
You think so? I mean,
just like they commit to a tour, you know.
Yeah, but then they'll have to stay in one place for an entire week.
You know, sometimes, especially the bigger acts, you know, like U2, they'll have a base and then they fly out for their show and they'll spend like a week in one city, but they'll fly out by jet to the different in that region. You know, they don't keep moving every night. They plant their flag, and then they fly it here, fly it there, and then they move everything again to another region, you know. So this is not unusual for bands, I don't think. In fact, it's, you know.
Yeah, I wonder, but for some of the smaller bands, whether Golden Voice and the promoters will have to pay for, you know, for these bands to live there for a week.
Yeah, really. Plus they have to, they can't play in the neighborhood.
Yeah, know, that's true.
If you're there for a week, you'd be like, what? I can't play at all?
Well, due to radius clauses, they might loosen up on the radius clauses because of that and allow bands to start playing a little bit earlier, bands that are showing up at the festival to start playing maybe in late March and during that week.
So this is basically a very simple way of meeting demand. They've got more people who want to buy tickets than can possibly go. They can't fit more people into the space. And if they split into two weekends... You know, the question is, does your fee increase by 50%, 70%, 20%? You know,
Right. You mean the cost of putting on the show itself.
Yeah, well, if you're paying for the act, you know, you're paying Joe Schmo to show up, or, you know, or do they get a cut of the gate? I'm not sure what happens at Coachella.
No, they get paid a booking fee.
They don't get a cut?
No, not that I know of.
I mean, not even the big ones? You know, the big ones usually when they play...
No, they usually, it's a booking fee. That's effectively how...
So unlike if I play Madison Square Garden, where I get a flat rate guarantee, plus if it's greater, I get a cut of the gate. When you go to a music festival, it's typically just a flat fee?
Yeah, booking fee. Yeah. It's a PA fee, a personal appearance fee. But what's interesting about this is none of the bands for next year are known yet. It's 10 months away. And tickets will go on sale in 2 days on Friday.
Oh.
Last year when tickets went on sale, I guess it was January or February. I think it was the last week of January. They sold out in 6 days. And that really surprised Golden Voice. So they said this year they wanted to allow other people to see the shows. So they will repeat them a week later. Now, this year they also did Coachella one weekend at Indio. Then the following weekend in Indio, they did this, you know, the big four Metallica heavy metal show. And then the weekend after that, they did Stagecoach. So they kind of proved that they could do three shows and three festivals back to back, weekend after weekend.
Well, I mean, promoters have to do that all the time, don't they?
Yes, but I guess they proved that they could do it and it didn't bankrupt them.
Yeah, that would be bad. And that heavy metal, the big four heavy metal concert is coming to Yankee Stadium, though I don't think I'm going, though a lot of my friends are. To see Metallica in Yankee Stadium is a big deal for some people.
Well, yes.
I didn't mean that.
I didn't know whether you were trying to move us along in a big deal or big whoop, because we still have television news to go over.
That's right.
Now,
I've been out of the country, so I've missed a lot of television.
So did you see Oprah's last show?
I just skimmed through it this morning. As with most sermons, if I can fast forward to the finale, I do. It was sort of a, you are your own light. You are your own energy. You're responsible for your own destiny. I learned from you. I'm incredibly rich and I learned from you. But
I'm incredibly rich part though.
No, she did she?
No, I'm kidding.
No. I did not watch every minute. It was nice. It was just her with the audience. Everybody knows what it was, but it was nicely done. You know, she's not going away forever. She has a cable channel, for heaven's sake. But it was classy. It was a nice goodbye. It was very new age, touchy-feely, you know, you are the future you see sort of thing. But it was elegantly done. It was a nice finale.
Well, it received the highest ratings that show has received in 17 years. 17 million people tuned in.
Well, I'm a little surprised, frankly, that it wasn't the highest rating she ever got. I mean, maybe was that the Michael Jackson show that she tied? I'm not sure what show beat it. I think it was actually a weird show. It was like a makeover show or a surprise show. It was not some big stunt celebrity show. As I recall reading the overnight ratings, it was some,
like,
you know,
show in 1993.
Yeah, it was not anything like Michael Jackson. Like, she got Michael Jackson in an interview. That was a big coup. But I'm a little surprised it wasn't the highest rated of all time. Doesn't matter. It's a new world we live in. It's a ton more. As she said, the show began when people would write in letters and put a stamp on an envelope to tell her what they thought of the show. Now, of course, you tweet and you post a comment on her website. So that's how long it's been around. It's a huge accomplishment. You know, she went out with style. Good for her.
Well, what about American Idol, which I guess increased its viewership year over year?
Unbelievable.
20% more than the 24.2 million people who turned in last year. 28 million people watched the final episode, I guess the conclusion of American Idol this year, where Humpty Dumpty, not Humpty Dumpty, Howdy Doody won the...
What's wrong with Scott McCreery?
I don't know. I've heard him referred to as Howdy Doody. I guess he looks like Howdy Doody.
I see that a little bit. Yeah. It was the finale increased 20% over last year. It's not the highest rated finale in Idol history. But to increase your audience overall in the 10th season, which is what they did, is amazing. I think only Law & Order ever increased year to year substantially that long into its run. It did it in like season 7 or 8 or 9 because of the reruns, started to goose the audience a lot. People loved the show so much in reruns, they started to tune into new episodes. That's what made Law & Order do that. This is its 10th season, and more importantly, it's the number one show in the country and has been so for 6 years in a row, and now it looks like 7 consecutive years. No other show in U.S. history comes even close to that. It's just by far and away the biggest hit of all time.
Well, and that 28 million viewers was kind of the average, because between 10 o'clock and I guess 10:15, 38 million people were tuning in, because that's when the winner is announced.
Right. That happens for all shows, you know, whether it's the Oscars or the Idol or whatever it might be. There's a peak viewership at the beginning or the end or the middle, whatever might be the most enticing moment. And in this case, yeah, the average is 28 million people tuned in for the finale. It's the winner was a teenager, Scott McCreary. I think he's 17. It was up in a lot of big demos for the first time in 2 or 3 years. I thought they were kind of boring finalists. And so I taped the finale and didn't even watch it. I just erased it off my DVR because I came back. I knew the solution. I knew who won. And I just didn't care that much. Though, you know, he's got a good voice and maybe he can pull it off.
Now, of course, you fast forwarded through Oprah. You didn't barely watch American Idol. But if you were watching and you weren't watching on a DVR, would you be looking at your iPhone or your iPad during commercials?
I've looked at my iPhone while we recorded this show. So I guess the answer is yes. I've gotten 3 texts while we're doing the show.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, according to IPG Media Lab and Yumi, it looks as
who are
if
these people,
I don't know. There's people who did some study. The advertising industry has, you know, long been in fear that the DVR was making people avoid television commercials. But now, they're saying that actually smartphones account for 60% of TV and 46% of online video distractions.
So they're saying when you're watching your TV and a commercial comes up, maybe you don't bother to fast forward through it, or maybe you haven't even DVR'd the show, but you will grab your phone and start playing with it.
Correct, yes. And this study is kind of a little odd because they only had 48 adult participants in some lab.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I think somewhat
you
slanted.
We shouldn't even be talking about
it. Well, the reason I'm talking about it is because I realize that I do the same thing. As a matter of fact, if the show is boring, I'm already looking at the iPad.
Well, I've said this many times. The Nielsen ratings now include, you know, overnight and next day and plus 1 day and plus 3 day and plus 7 day information. And they estimate that within the first 3 days of a show's airing that, you know, this number of people watch it on their DVR. And the numbers that they include are like the top numbers, like 3.4 million, you know, for like, say, Big Bang Theory or House or whatever. You know, the increase in viewership is at the most like 3 million people. And I just don't get it. I just can't believe there aren't that many more people watching shows on DVR because I do it so much. It just seems that they're missing a lot.
I hardly ever watch a show that's not DVR, but sometimes I'll let the commercials play.
I can't even bear to watch live sporting events live anymore. I DVR baseball game. I just can't bear to sit there through the commercials and all the downtime.
I DVR'd the Oscars this year.
Ooh, well, yeah, you know, there's one of those rare events, the Oscars, the Super Bowl, probably American Idol finale. You want to see it when it happens. It's no fun 2 hours later.
Well, so, it's no fun when you open Twitter and it kind of spoils everything.
So those special events will still pull in a live audience. But for regular television programming, I literally do not watch shows live ever. And I sure as heck fast forward through the advertising.
Well, according to Ad Age in this study, it looks like DVRs are not the problem, but smartphones and iPads are.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just on Grindr. I didn't have time. What were you saying?
Oh, never mind. I thought this story was a big deal, but not according to Michael.
Well, it is a big deal that it identifies a problem as far as the industry is concerned, but it's a big whoop as far as not a very well done or interesting study.
Ooh, yes, indeed. That does bring us to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story this week is about Blockbuster, which, of course, the Dish Network or Dish Service or Satellite Service, they purchased them, and now they are lowering film rental prices. Thousands of rental movies will be available in stores for 99 cents per day, and the company is promoting single-day rentals. Just-release movies will be priced at $2.99 for the first day, while other new releases will cost $1.99 for the first day. Additional rental days for all movies are priced at 99 cents per day. This is like three-card Monty.
Is there any movie that costs 99 cents per day, period?
I have no idea. I mean, is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop because Blockbuster's a fading franchise, but it's funny. It shows how Redbox is not some sort of crazy, ridiculous, insane thing. You know, a buck a day is not bad. You're going to hold it for 2 or 3 days. It's a perfectly reasonable price.
Our next story is about Flixster, the movie listing and info service that Time Warner brought earlier this month. They're going to provide a user-friendly interface for people who want to manage their home video collections in the digital cloud. So from music in the digital cloud to videos in the digital cloud.
I don't get this at all.
The company CFO John Martin told an investor conference sponsored by Barclays Capital that consumers will soon be able to upload your existing physical DVDs, have the ability to access them across multiple devices anywhere you want, have the ability to manage your collections with social aspects as well, go in, have friends see what movie collections they have, and see who has been watching those films.
I don't understand this at all. I can't say it's a big deal, a big whoop, because I don't get it. Are you saying that they'll list the movies you own online? Are they saying there will be a digital copy available that you can screen on multiple devices online? I don't know.
He didn't really go into it. But here's the thing. If they allow you to upload the movie online, first of all, it's going to take forever. Okay, so let's just start with the broadband problem.
Here. And the cost. I mean, my thousands of CDs are costing, you know, like a couple thousand bucks to put on the Amazon cloud. What are they going to charge me for movies? $500,000?
Yeah, I have no idea whether they charge at all. But now here's the thing. Ripping a DVD, you can rip one copy of a DVD as backup for yourself. And technically, you're not supposed to be ripping DVDs at all. There's actually copy protection on them to prevent that. So how do they expect us to rip and upload these DVDs unless they're just going to kind of read the thumbprint and then provide the video for us online?
Right. They're not going to physically upload the movie any more than they upload the music.
Right. That kind of thing. Well, I mean, in some cases, you do have to upload music, like for Amazon. You know, maybe with Flixster, you won't have to upload the DVD.
But the Amazon's not going to physically upload your music. They'll just see what music you have and then, they're not going to recopy it.
Have you used the service yet?
That's what they do?
Yeah. You have to upload the music.
Every single track on
every single track. Same with Google, by the way.
Well, but by the way, this also, I object to your saying that you don't have the right to rip them, because I believe you do. You have perfectly legal right to make a copy of a movie that you purchased legally so that you have a backup in case it gets damaged. That is fair use. That's absolutely legal, even if they try to put something on the DVD to stop you from doing it.
Yes, the DMCA, one copy for backup purposes, that is allowed.
No. That's their argument. That is not law.
That is law. DMCA. If you read the DMCA, one copy, fair use, for backup purposes.
When did they pass that one?
Like 1998.
That's crazy. Anyway.
The DMCA takedown notices. The X Factor continues to make news before it airs. This time, not in a good way. One of the four judges, pop singer Cheryl Cole, who had dissed former Pussycat Doll singer Nicole Scherzinger, who, when Nicole popped into the UK edition. Then Cole got sick and Scherzinger took over her spot, essentially an addition for a role on the American version where Nicole indeed was named one of the co-hosts. Any concerns they might butt heads are pointless. Cole has been sacked and Scherzinger has taken her place as one of the four judges alongside Simon Cowell, Paula Abdul, and L.A. Reid. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal. This is the most anticipated show of the fall. She hasn't even begun on it yet in the U.S. She's done very well in the U.K. with the show. And they're dumping her at this stage. And now Nicole Scherzinger is becoming a judge, right? Now there'll just be one host and she'll be one of the four judges.
Who?
I find this unbelievable. I'm not quite sure why. We've gotten all sorts of excuses. Maybe her accent. Maybe she's not well known enough in America. You know, like Nicole Scherzinger is a household name. But, you know, I don't think the show's in trouble. But it's a big, big change to have right before they launch.
Inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah. And she's a big star in the UK. I mean, she's, you know.
Well, maybe they can understand her accent.
Yeah. Ouch.
No, what I'm saying is that they had, one of the reasons given was that possibly Americans might not understand her accent, her English accent.
I've never heard her speak, so I wouldn't know. But there you go. Nicole did an okay job when she was on the singing competition show, The Sing-Off, hosted by Jessica Simpson's ex-husband. And
Nick Lachey.
Yeah, so she could be okay.
I cannot believe I knew that at the drop of a hat.
That's very good. She was more in the Paula Abdul camp. Nobody on that show wanted to say anything negative. So I'm not sure how she'll do in the X Factor, where you probably needed to be a little more tougher. But we'll see.
Amazon hopes to dominate books the way Apple is dominating music. Apple sells the iPod and the digital files that go on it. Now that Amazon sells the Kindle, it wants to start publishing books as well. The industry is very concerned about Amazon's hiring of Lawrence Kirschbaum, the former CEO of Time Warner Book Group, to head a new publishing imprint. How many books do they want to sell? What genres? What authors? No one knows, and Amazon isn't telling. Yet. Is this serious push into publishing a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal. I think it's, you know, classic vertical integration that maybe the Justice Department should look into. I mean, they're now going to start publishing books. I know publishers were very upset when Barnes & Noble started publishing their own editions of classic books. You know, here's their Great Expectations, buy their copy. And Amazon moving into new books, this is it's very scary news for the industry. It's had a lot of shockwaves. And, you know, if they're that dominant in book selling and in the Kindle, is there some antitrust issue here? I don't know.
Well, that's true. There could be down the line if they became big enough, certainly. Moving on to the Academy Awards. In one printed letter dated May 19th, 2011, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, you know, those guys who throw the Oscars, they informed their almost 6,000 members that change was coming. I don't think they did it, though, in like the Bob Dylan tune, Times Are Changing. Okay. The times will be changing as soon as members mail in what email address they would prefer to be contacted at in the future. Yes, as early as next year, Academy members will discard mail ballots with a new online voting system. To say this is a sea change is an understatement, because with electronic voting, all the established rules about how long you need to run the Academy Awards timetable gets thrown out the window, and that comes from hitfix.com. Michael,
What rules have been thrown out? This is a big deal. I think it's a big whoop. It's a technicality. It's nice. It's interesting. It should come to, you know, voting in our public world as well, you know, for Congress and Senate and the House and the president. But why does it change all the rules?
Well, what they're saying, and this is HitFix again, is saying, and a lot of people are saying this, is that the reason that the Academy Awards were held at the end of February and, you know, at one point the end of March, is because everybody needed time to mail out the ballots, fill out the ballots, mail them back, have them counted.
Malarkey.
Well, that's what was said by the Academy in years past. Now, of course, if you have the ability to vote online in an instant, well, you could actually tighten that production schedule down
to a
couple of weeks.
That's a big whoop. It does not affect what the bottleneck in that is watching movies. It's not filling out the form and mailing it. That does not take a lot of time.
Well,
you know, that's malarkey. It's 6,000 people. You can count them in a day, for God's sakes. It's not, you know, the presidential election. It's 6,000 ballots. You got to get them in. You got to wait for them to arrive. So, yeah, you've got a 3-day span. They're all in L.A. mostly, you know. I'm sure there's some in New York. But, yeah, you got to wait
London,
for them to arrive.
And
you have to wait for them to arrive by a certain deadline. But big deal. That is not a bottleneck of time. The issue is watching the movies. It's not filling out the form and mailing it in. That is not the thing that's been holding back the Academy all these years. So they're wrong, and I say it's a big whoop.
Well, they tried to make Amy Winehouse go to rehab, and she said,
"No, don't do it."
Yeah, okay. I wasn't going to sing the song. The singer's rep confirmed to People magazine that the 27-year-old singer, she's only 27, good grief, she checked into a rehab clinic on Wednesday as part of an ongoing battle with alcohol addiction. She, quote, has embarked on a treatment program at the Priory Clinic. She wants to be ready for performances in Europe this summer and decided to seek an assessment. She will remain at the rehab clinic on doctor's advice. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Oh, it's a big whoop in the scheme of the world. It's a big deal for her. The problem here is that you've got a tour lined up and all this stuff. You can't do rehab in like a time frame. I don't want to judge her. I wish her the best, but I wish she would just throw everything over, cancel everything, and get her life in order, because she's a very talented person, and I hope she keeps making music for years to come. But squeezing in rehab between tours is not the way to make it happen, though I hope it works for her.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd prefer to see a healthy Amy Winehouse next year or the year after, rather than an Amy Winehouse that didn't get through rehab properly.
Yeah, you can't just plan to do it in a few weeks before your summer tour launches. She's got an incredible amount of pressure on her, but she's been so long between albums in this pop world sense of things that just put everything on hold. Fire anybody who's trying to force you to go back on tour and meet these commitments. Just cancel everything and go into rehab and do it seriously and really. And, you know, you can't do it in a few weeks with this attitude of like, I want to get ready for the tour. You're not working out to, you know, lose a few pounds. You're trying to put your life back in order.
So you're saying, you know, make a sober decision.
Oh, God.
Okay, maybe we should move on. Courtney Love.
Speaking of rehab.
She's been sued again for defamation on Twitter. I can't help but laugh when I read this. It's been only a few months since Courtney Love paid to settle that unique lawsuit claiming she defamed a fashion designer via Twitter. Now the Hollywood Reporter is reporting the rocker has been sued again for comments made online, this time by lawyers who represented her in an effort to pursue money allegedly stolen from the estate of her late husband, Kurt Cobain.
I'm confused. What?
Basically, she's being sued by lawyers that used to represent her because she went on Twitter and said some very nasty things about them. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. But, you know, as with anything printed, be careful of what you say.
Yeah, and somebody should kick Courtney Love off Twitter. She should not be allowed to use Twitter.
If she had a social media person in charge of her, like Karen Woodward, she'd be off Twitter.
That's probably true. Now, our last story, we didn't really write anything up for it, but it looks like Paul Simon, Santana, and Herbie Hancock are protesting the Grammy category cuts.
Well, you know, I haven't read up on this, but, you know, they're artists who are very big, very popular, and they're sort of the sort of people that the Grammys should have consulted with before they made their decision. Presumably artists were involved in these discussions. Anybody who creates music for, like, Hawaiian music obviously is very devastated when they say, ah, we're going to cut your category, we're going to cut the Tejano category, and just lump them all into this, that, and the other category. And I understand that. I think I did. My initial reaction was that it was good that there was too many, you know, narrower types of categories being made available at the Grammys that sort of diluted the impact of them. You know, when the same artist wins best polka album year after year after year, you got to look back and say, well, maybe we're not doing the best thing for this.
Maybe they're the only
genre
ones playing polka.
Well, that, you know, maybe this genre would be better served by competing in a slightly broader category where when something notable happens and they break out, it actually makes news rather than just being your own little cul-de-sac. But it's nice to see artists like these speaking up. It's probably too little too late. I don't know that they're necessarily right, but I appreciate the fact that they're speaking up for those artists who this sort of these sort of minor genres that we dismiss are the only recognition those people get in their careers.
Well, this is a coalition of musicians which is demanding the Recording Academy restore more than, I guess, 30 categories to the Grammy Awards. And they're alleging that these reductions target ethnic music and were done without the input of the membership itself. And they held a big protest last Thursday in Beverly Hills. So that's the story there.
Was there any reaction from the Grammys? Did they say we're taking into consideration or did they just ignore it?
They said, you know, we will definitely reconsider things for 2013. We're going to see how it goes this year for 2012.
Yeah.
Well, that concludes Big Deal, Big Whoop and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. Although this week, I think everyone's going to care. Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe, had a front page story the Sunday before last, which explained that moviegoers in the Boston area are being left in the dark thanks to the regular misuse of the lenses on new digital projection equipment at many of the region's major theater chains. Burr joins us now to discuss his article and the response it received. Ty, thank you for being here.
Sure. Thanks for asking me.
Ty, I love this story. It's so fascinating. Studios have been spending and theaters so much money to upgrade to IMAX and digital projection and 3D. They're touting what a great visual experience and audio experience you can get at your local movie theater. And then through laziness or indifference, they're cheating theatergoers out of a good theatrical experience. How did you find out about this issue?
Well, myself and a lot of the other Boston area movie critics have been noticing that, especially at the screenings we go to at the multiplex downtown, that the films have been dark. And I've been noticing it when I go out with, you know, my wife or my kids to see a movie on the weekends, that more often than not, the films seem unusually dark. And we started talking about it. And we ultimately, after talking with some of the projectionists, some of whom wanted to go on the record, some of whom didn't, many of whom didn't, we traced it down to the fact that a lot of the new digital projectors, especially the ones made by Sony, put on a 3D special lens when they're showing a 3D movie. Now, they should be taking that lens off when they're showing a 2D movie, but they're not, or rather the theater personnel doesn't have the training, and they're not really getting the orders from the corporate headquarters or the technicians that sort of go back and forth between them to take these lenses off. And those lenses cut light out, so you're getting a darker picture. And there's also other reasons. There's, you know, burned out bulbs. Often theaters, you know, use the projection bulbs far past their recommended use date. There's many, many issues. But the one thing that seemed common was that, especially on the Sonys, it's too difficult for the average theater personnel to, they have to log in, they have to do all sorts of things to get this lens off. It's a 20-minute procedure. Even Sony admits that. And pretty much almost all cases, the theater management is saying, just forget about it.
Well, now, you did kind of pinpoint that one of the issues is with the Sony 4K projectors, which require a polarizing lens to separate the two images to left and right, which then get projected onto the screen. What did Sony or AMC or Regal have to say about this issue?
Well, the funny thing was, you know, I approached them all with very specific questions about this. And the three major exhibition chains, AMC, Regal, and National Amusements, which is big in the New England area, and Sony, all basically refused to answer any questions and just put out boilerplate. Everybody, you know, the audiences are happy with our digital presentation. And in fact, Sony, I spoke to a spokesman at Sony who said, sure, I'll set you up with an executive, give me all your questions. 2 days go by and he says, we will not participate in this article. And then later they come out and put a very sort of low key rebuttal of some of my claims on the web. I got some minor technical issues wrong, but a lot of their rebuttal is just sort of tap dancing around the main issue.
So rather, while they've been spending six figures to refurbish their movie theaters, theater by theater, if not more money, instead of saying, gee, this is a problem, we want to provide as good a product as possible, they're sort of dancing around the topic and pretending it doesn't exist.
Well, what they're saying is that a properly prepared Sony digital projector will put forth a perfectly great image. And that, you know, that's absolutely true. The issue is that it's too difficult to easily change the lens. And this is not the case with other digital projection managers from companies like Barco and Christie and NEC, primarily with the Sonys. It takes too long. Even, like I said, even Sony admits it takes 20 minutes to change the lens. That's a long time, and it requires a lot of technical know-how from theater personnel that aren't trained. That's the other part of the equation, that the theater management, the exhibition chain management, they're not training their personnel. And they're pretty much, and they're walking away from this saying, you know, it's just too much trouble, too much time, too much money.
Well, a couple points here. One, projectionists are kind of going by the wayside in a way.
Correct.
You know, managers are doing the job of what a trained union projectionist used to do, because now all you need to do to start a film is press a button.
That's right. In fact, I have one of my experts calls them manjectionists. and, you know, they press a button, but they're not checking what's going on in each theater. So often you'll be sitting in a theater, there'll be problems with the sound. You go out, you know, or with the image, or it's poorly framed, or, you know, any number of problems. You go out and try and find somebody to fix it, and you can't.
Oh, I do that all the time. I have to leave a theater. It happens regularly in movie theaters. You have to leave, go out and tell somebody something's wrong because there's nobody in the booth, even for the first 5 minutes, just to make sure everything's going okay. Right. And I understand that 20 minutes is a fair amount of time to change a lens, but don't movies stay sort of on a screen for like a week or at least a few, three or four? It's not like they have to do it every show or every screen.
No. They do it for, you know, most movies these days, you know, the least amount of run is a week. So yeah, absolutely. They should be doing it. And I've heard reports that a lot of these, the Sonys are being installed and they don't even send them the 2D lenses. They just send them the 3D lenses and they leave them
on. Oh my God.
Well, that I can actually understand. And that polarization does, it cuts the light by 50%. And part of the reason that it takes so long and there's so much effort on the Sony projector is because when you're removing that lens, it's a security issue. And of course, these studios want to make sure nobody's stealing their movie by projecting it onto a, you know, an image capture device.
What do you mean?
Meaning that you could project an image onto something that could actually capture and record directly the film.
You know, Sony, as the one digital projector manufacturer that's also allied with a content producer, as opposed to Christie and Barco and NEC, they're paranoid so that they've made it. You are able to change the lens and remove the polarizer device, which is a separate device, without having to log in. But if you want to do, as projectionists have explained to me, you know, sure, you can change the lens from a 3D to a 2D, but then you have to get in there and tweak it and make it right. Otherwise, it's just going to look terrible. So to do that, you actually have to input, you know, a login, get in there, and if you do it wrong, it shuts down on you, and it's a really complicated procedure.
And I'll tell you, when one of those projectors shuts down, it shuts down for good. You have to have a service repair person come out and, you know, boot it back up and get it back online, because, and it shuts down for a reason, for security purposes.
Absolutely.
So Ty, if you're sitting in an audience, obviously you haven't seen the film before, probably, so you're only going to be guessing if it's murky or darker than it should be. Is there anything people in the audience can look for to tell them whether a movie is being projected properly in 2D versus 3D, or what's going on with the lenses?
You know, and it's funny, a lot of theater managers and projectionists will tell me, you know, they hear the audiences come out and say, oh man, that was a, you know, the director really, you know, shot that really dark, and they blame it on the filmmakers. You know, as I've been told, it's not rocket science. You should have a clean, well-lit, crisp, good-sounding film experience. It's just basically that easy. If you feel like the film is really dark, like it's just looking too murky, like you can't, in dark scenes, it's just so shadowy, you can't tell what's going on. In bright daylight scenes, it looks gray rather than, you know, a well-lit picture. Yeah, there's an issue going on there. And also one way to check to see if you're seeing a 2D movie being projected through a 3D lens is look back at the projection booth. If there are two images, one stacked on top of the other, I originally wrote in the article that that's true only of the Sony 4K projectors, but it actually turns out to be true of the some of the other manufacturers. Then that is and you're paying for a 2D movie, and you see two images on the projector window, that's being shown through a 3D lens. It's being split.
Cool. So you look at that beam of light coming out of the projection booth, and if there's two of them, that's a 3D lens, and if it's one, that's a 2D lens?
Yeah, one stacked on top of the other, exactly.
Cool. It seems unbelievable to me that they would spend all this money to create state-of-the-art technology and then not bother with an issue like this, which completely, you know, damages the quality of what people are seeing.
Well, you know, it's for a lot of these chains, it's not about the movie experience. They make their money on the concessions. You know, I've heard, you know, projections joke that basically the movie theaters are a restaurant with, you know, a screen at the end. That's, you know, if you really go into it, they really don't care that much about the film projection experience because they know that a lot of audiences won't really object to it. We've got this crowd mentality. We sit down, we suspect that maybe something's not perfect, but we're loath to get up, leave the movie, drop out of the story, make a ruckus. And then when we do, you know, they'll say, okay, if you do go to the management and say, you know, it's a lousy experience, give me my money back. Well, they'll give you passes. You know, they'll give you free passes for another movie because that just gets you to come in and have more food. The thing to do, if you really feel strongly about it, is insist on getting your money back and say, the heck with the passes.
Well, you know, on a slightly related issue, 3D movie going seems to be trending down a bit. People at first jumped into it and they'd go see everything in 3D. And now, especially families with children say, my God, this is a huge ticket increase in the cost of going to a movie. And it's not wowing me that much. And you're seeing people resisting more and more, even on opening weekend, going to 2D rather than a 3D, even in a movie like Kung Fu Panda 2 or Pirates of the Caribbean, where it's sort of made for 3D. Do you see that? Do you see audiences reacting to that as well and saying, you know, we want a good theatrical experience, but we want to spend a reasonable amount of money and, you know, stop trying to raise the price 18 different ways?
Well, here's one thing that happened. We got the first, you know, 2 years ago, we got the first wave of really nice 3D movies capped by Avatar, of course. And then last year, it was really a big run of post-production conversion 3D, where they don't shoot the movie in 3D using, you know, specially equipped cameras, but they basically, it's like computer colorization, except applying it to three dimensions rather than color.
They did that with Thor, and they did that with...
They did that with Thor, they did that with Clash of the Titans, which was a hideous 3D job. And there were far too many movies like that that came out, and people could tell. People said, you know, it just didn't look right, and you're paying, you know, $15 instead of $10. I mean, it's just, and yet multiply that by the number of, you know, people in your family, it's just not worth it. So yeah, people were burned.
And can you explain to me why anyone pays extra bucks to go see a movie in IMAX when it hasn't been shot in IMAX? A movie, you know, the IMAX experience for most movies, it's hard. You got to get a really good seat. It's hard to capture everything. It's such a big screen. I don't understand why people pay that extra premium price.
Well, you know, it's a brand name. And in fact, you know, the IMAX that we see now in multiplex theaters, I have friends who call it LIMAX, you know, because it's not what we think of and what's been sold to us for so many years as IMAX with that giant, giant screen that's, you know, it seems like it's the size of a football field and the battery of speakers and that whole really intense experience. The IMAX that they're installing into multiplexes now, it's just basically a big screen movie, you know, with a really powerful digital projector. And it's not that much bigger than the traditional film screen. It's just a big movie screen. It really isn't IMAX the way that, you know, IMAX was originally created. But it's a brand name, and they've realized that they can make money off the brand name.
Well, you know, I know some people who refer to it as FIMAX, as fake IMAX. Kind of. Now, your article was published, I guess, a week and a half ago on Sunday. I know Barco and Cinemark, who uses Barco projectors, they've had a field day with this, and they've, you know, released press releases that talk about how bright their projectors are in 3D and 2D. But what has the reaction been across the country? Because this really kind of made some headlines, didn't it?
Well, especially when a couple of really influential bloggers, including Roger Ebert, you know, once Ebert picks it up, and he sort of quoted my story and spun it, you know, advanced it a bit. And once he picks it up, a lot of other people pick it up and run with it. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk with it in, about it within sort of film aficionado circles and technical circles. It isn't something that's really, I feel like, radiated out to the general public, which is frustrating to me, but it's the kind of thing where you have to keep hitting it. And in fact, Sony put out their rebuttal. I'm preparing a rebuttal to their rebuttal, which is probably going to go up on the Globe's movie blog in a day or two. And part of that is talking, you know, I've been talking to the original article brought a lot of projectionists across the company, across the country to send me emails. And I'm getting a lot of details about how difficult these projectors actually are to maintain and how little support the projectionists are getting from their, you know, their corporate HQ.
Well, Ty, thank you very much for joining us. Of course, all of your writing can be found on the Boston Globe website, or, you know, if you are in the area, you can actually purchase a real live newspaper.
And, yes, they still exist.
Yeah, remarkably. And you're also on Twitter. Ty Burr is your username on Twitter.
Correct.
Well, thank you for joining us to talk about this.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Well, thanks for Ty Burr for coming by. That was really interesting. I've been at a lot of movies where I felt like something wasn't right. And I bet I've been seeing movies in with, you know, 3D lenses muffling the image, and I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to tell because the image is quite dark. Although, as Ty Burr points out in his piece, audiences really aren't educated to look for that kind of thing or know what it looks like.
Yeah, I wouldn't know whether it was just a poorly shot movie or what was going on. You know, I'm sure I've sat through it. I'm sure this happens everywhere. These issues are not related to Boston. The complications of dealing with the lenses, of dealing with the projectors, of just being not worth the effort for the people. And, you know, one guy has to handle a lot more projections than they used to do before. It's clearly happening all over the country.
Yeah, you know, the question I forgot to ask Ty, and I kind of regret it now, is that he said that Sony gave the projectors to AMC and Regal in exchange for advertising time in front of these movies. And that's the first I've ever heard of that. I don't know.
Of an in-kind sort of like, we give you free projectors, you just run our ads before every movie?
Right. And I'm going to email him and ask about that because that's the first I've ever heard of that.
Yeah, because that seems like an awfully expensive ad buy.
Yeah. Well, and plus, you know, there are VPFs, virtual print fees in place to take care of the projector and digital cinema equipment.
So the next time you go to the movies, look for those beams of light and make sure you're seeing the movie projected properly.
Yes, and if you have any problem hearing our podcast, if we're not being projected properly, you can
actually... In 3D.
Or 4D. Sorry. Yeah, no. you can write to us. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can give us a call. Our voicemail address, our phone number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can call us and leave us a voicemail. Now, you can find all of that information as well as links to all of the stories we discussed on today's episode, not to mention all of our past episodes, on our website at showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to subscribe in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or your RSS reader. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael can be found on, well, his website, michaelgiltz.com, or on Twitter. I can be found on Twitter or on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.